Well, it has been a year since the world was turned on its head due to COVID-19, but the development, testing, and now distribution of multiple vaccines has issued in a new era of scientific breakthroughs that, well, quite frankly, we have never seen before. But the reality is, not everyone who is eligible to get the shot will choose to get it. Vaccine hesitancy remains a major health challenge globally and here at home. Now, a new book delves deeper into the root causes of that hesitancy, some of the cultural sensitivities at play, and the best practices to combat public mistrust. Maya Goldenberg is the author of Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. She's also an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph. And Maya has been good enough to join us now on the line for more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for taking the time with us. I know you began this book years before we were thrust into this pandemic. Just how long has vaccine hesitancy posed a challenge to public health?
Vaccine hesitancy has been around as long as vaccines have been around. So starting with the first vaccine created to fight smallpox, this was in the late 1700s by the English physician Edward Jenner, there was an anti-vaccine movement that arose in response to it. But now what's interesting about vaccine hesitancy is it tends to reflect the cultural anxieties of the moment. So the reasons people hesitate have changed over time, but all the while vaccines are sort of this signal of public mistrust. That I've seen that historically watching the arc of vaccine hesitancy from 1796 right up until today.
Can you take us through how those cultural anxieties have changed over the decades?
Sure. I mean, I can just give you a few historic examples to give you a sense of it. When Jenner first introduced the smallpox vaccine, he used pus from a cowpox. So that's something close to smallpox that affected cattle, but not people. He used that, entered it into the body system by placing it under the skin, and it elicited the kind of immune response needed to fight off not just cowpox, but smallpox. And people at the time thought that this was anti-religious or sinful to mix species, human and cow. And because of that, they were concerned about the sort of religious implications of that. Now, those kinds of concerns are not around anymore. We also don't need to immunize against smallpox. But as anti-vaccine movements have progressed over time, they reflect the period. So there was growing anti-vaccine sentiment in the 1970s as the women's movement and the patients' rights, as well as other civil rights movements, were growing. And somehow vaccines came to be seen as symbols of the patriarchal system of medicine that women's objected to, and the kind of medical paternalism that patients objected to. They wanted more decision-making. So you see there that vaccines pivoted to represent the thing that was politically problematic at the time.
Those anxieties that you mentioned there, just a couple of the examples, that, you know, they're obviously quite diverse, but is there an overarching connection between hesitancies over the year that you can also draw?
I'd say it's always something about people feeling lack of control over a difficult situation. So no, to answer your question, no, there's always something specific to the moment. I guess the question might be why vaccines and not other medical interventions. And there is something about vaccines that elicits a very strong public response. Until COVID, most of our vaccines have been targeted at children, so that's bound to create some kind of anxiety about safety and protecting our children. It's also, until recently, it was introducing a dangerous pathogen into an otherwise healthy body. So those are some reasons that vaccines elicit this kind of response in a way that pharmaceuticals and treatments don't.
Vaccine hesitancy, though, can be often viewed as almost an unwillingness to understand the science behind it all and what's at play here. How
right.
fair would you say that is?
I think that is an unfair that's an unfair representation of it. There's this widely held view, one that I spent half of my book arguing against, that the reason people hesitate about vaccines is because they don't understand the science, or even worse, they might be science denialists, something more like that. And my research suggested that that is a convenient view to sort of separate us vaccine acceptors versus those who don't, but it doesn't really pan out. It doesn't actually correlate with what we actually see among vaccine hesitant people. There's a lot of social science research, and it is not the case that vaccine hesitators are less educated or don't understand science. Instead, it also doesn't capture how people interact with science information. It is not the case that people who read the science then understand that they should vaccinate and that's the end of it. Instead, people have all kinds of interactions with scientific information, how they read it, how they interpret it. They look to their friends and their peers for how they should prioritize it. And because of that, the lack of understanding is not what's the driver. It's not showing to be the driver of vaccine hesitancy. In fact, I spend a lot of time wondering why that theory that there's some kind of science illiteracy or misinformation problem, that being the driver, why that's such a persistent view of vaccine hesitators when there's so much evidence against that view.
So if not at science, where then is that mistrust aimed?
I think the mistrust is aimed at the public institutions of science and government institutions that are meant to protect us. So all the arguments against vaccine hesitancy seem to be pointing at the institution somehow being either unjust or untrustworthy. People understand what the consensus is on vaccines. They know the scientists and doctors are largely in favor of vaccines, but they don't trust the source. They think there's something wrong within this institutional framework that is allegedly supposed to keep us safe. Some people say, I don't know if they're going to keep me safe.
And so I guess one of the questions then is, what's the difference then if someone chooses to not to have mistrust in a medical health officer as opposed to the actual science at play? If in the end the results are the same and some people choose not to be vaccinated, and that poses a public danger.
It is the same danger, but it does give us some idea about where we should be targeting vaccine outreach and how we should be trying to get the public on board with vaccines. So we all agree that getting the public vaccinated is generally a good thing. I think everyone agrees on that. But trying to keep educating the public, which is what most of our science communications does, you know, fact-based education, myth-busting is a very popular pastime. And the assumption seems to be there is that once you provide that information, people are suddenly going to go, aha, now I need to vaccinate. But if it is true that it's a problem of trust, not a problem of scientific information, then all the studies and all the fact sheets in the world is not going to convince people.
And so how then do you gain that trust? What needs to change from, say, you know, the status quo? We're in the middle of a pandemic right now. What would have to change?
Right. So there are sort of small interventions that can be done, and there are larger ones that may be difficult to enact at this time. The first, the easier one, is to have very respectful conversations with people who are vaccine hesitant. There was, in my work on vaccine hesitant parents regarding childhood vaccines, there was this common narrative of mothers, often new mothers, going to their healthcare provider with questions about vaccines and getting shut down in the process, made to feel stupid or made to feel selfish for even asking questions about vaccines. And it's those same mothers who felt badly about that situation, went online or went to a community group, and then found the community they needed and the information they wanted, and sometimes ended up far more vaccine hesitant than they were initially. So the first thing you do is you have respectful conversations, you listen to where people's fears are, and you try to do it without judgment. That's an easy thing to do. Because primary care providers are the most trusted source for health information, they should be given time and remuneration in order to do this. I know doctors feel really stressed with the time that's needed to build these kind of trusting relationships with their patients, and they should have the time to do it. So those are the easy ones. The broader ones are more demanding. You have to look at the sources of mistrust, which at least around pediatric vaccines, I found to be public dissatisfaction with the conflicts of interest that are present in healthcare research and practice and industry. So people say, I don't trust big pharma, I don't trust that the regulatory process is robust enough. Many, many parents say this. So this would actually be a good time to finally address conflicts of interest in healthcare research. That's a tall order, I know. The other one is recognize that some communities, well, we already do recognize that some communities are more vaccine hesitant because they have historic and present distrust and have experienced medical racism and gender and other kinds of injustice in the hands of healthcare. We need to correct those problems and make the healthcare experience better for marginalized communities, and then vaccines will become more acceptable.
Well, I'm glad you brought that last point up, especially because we know that not all vaccine hesitancy is born out of any misguided understanding of science. And as you point out, there's real and lasting damage that's caused to, say, that the Black and Indigenous communities who have been abused at the hands of the medical community in the past. How do you even begin to approach that?
Well, one is to fix the system. So anti-oppression training and anti-racism training at all levels of health training, getting more representation within healthcare and public health. We do not have enough Black and Indigenous public health officers and physicians and nurses. So that needs to be a major priority. We don't do enough to do that. We need to recruit students, recruit faculty, and retain them, and change the face of healthcare to be more representative, because that improves, that's well known to improve the experience of patients who are from racialized groups. So that's one thing that needs to be done, is fix the healthcare and public health system. Another thing that is actually being done now, and I really applaud the work of groups like the South Asian COVID Task Force, and in Toronto there's the Black Scientist Task Force. So this is local organizing of scientists and doctors from these communities of color to actually provide mainly webinars and those kinds of Q&A or town hall meetings all online to the communities that are very hesitant about vaccines. So people can go to these webinars. They're generally accessible and free, and they can talk to scientists and doctors that come from their community. And these messages are more trusted when it comes from people who know your history and share your values, and also validate the concerns that people have about healthcare about healthcare and the healthcare experience for marginalized communities.
Maya, I'm curious, what role do you see social media playing these days, especially when it comes to the general mistrust that exists?
Social media is certainly not helping. Social media is a platform for amplifying a lot of misinformation, but I don't see that as the driver of vaccine hesitancy. It's people who are already mistrusting that go to social media, and then they might become might be exposed and affected by more radical views. To suggest that everything would be fine if social media wasn't there isn't true. Most media consumers know that the information that you access online is of varied quality. So you need to be asking, why is it that people don't just go to the Public Health Agency of Canada website and stop there, because that's the information, that's the credible source of information. Instead, people presumably go to those sources, are not satisfied with what they see there, and then keep looking online. And that's where you get all kinds of theories and all kinds of ideas about vaccines, and some of them, of course, are not credible.
You talked about the need to be more respectful when it comes to dialogue and to not back people into a corner and for them to get defensive and go online and I suppose spread conspiracies or inaccuracies. But I'm wondering, is there a danger as well by not strongly calling out inaccuracies or conspiracies that can end up leading groups to actually feel galvanized?
Right. There is absolutely reason to do it. I didn't want to suggest that we shouldn't be providing information and correcting misinformation. I only question why so much priority is placed on this kind of communications. I'd say 99% of science communications are the fact-based learning. And I say, what about all the other sources of mistrust? So yes, there are people looking for information and they need it. There are people who are getting misinformation and would benefit from correctives. But we need to recognize that experience and that the way that they are interacting with information is shaped by the trusting relationships they have with experts, with healthcare. So we need to be looking at that too.
And just on that note, given that one's experience with the healthcare system can inform how they feel about it moving forward, we are right now in the middle of perhaps the greatest scientific experiment as far as a global vaccine rollout has ever gone. What might the lasting impacts of this vaccine distribution, of what happens over the course of the next few weeks and months, mean for the way people look at vaccines and just more generally medicine in the future?
That's a good question. I mean, this needs to go well. Unfortunately, everything is high stakes, so every step along the way is doing things to shape people's attitude around government and around healthcare. So we really want to do it right. Right now, the rollout is clunky. It could be more efficient. The rollout has not adequately addressed global priority. So the sort of global injustices are not being adequately addressed. So the hope is we can do better, because this is a time where we need a lot of solidarity around community and community practices, which include vaccination.
Maya, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You take care. That's Maya Goldenberg, who's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph, and she is the author of the new book, Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. And have a listen to this. Can you guess what that sound was? It's actually the sound of a world record time in competitive rope skipping in the 32nd event. Now, a number of Ontario jumpers will find out soon whether they have won a medal at the International Jump Rope World Championships. The event was supposed to be held in Ottawa over the summer, but COVID stopped that from happening. So instead, the competition went viral, or virtual rather, and the results are expected soon. Two of Canada's top competitors are members of the Lincoln Leapers, a rope skipping team in the Niagara region. And joining us now to tell us more about the sport is Sydney McLennan,